Coming up, we got a loaded episode with Kirk Anderson, Spike Eskin, Jonathan Macri, and a huge gambling scandal now in the NBA. That's all coming up right now. All right, now joining me to discuss more of the Mavericks and the Spurs, Kirk Henderson. Kirk, how are you feeling this morning after that loss last night to the San Antonio Spurs and Victor Wembanyama just looking like a true alien?
Bleak. It's not good. You spend all summer after lucking into the number one draft pick, talking yourself into a roster of all forwards, only to come out and post an offensive rating worse than anything they did last season. A season where they sometimes struggled to field a team. So I don't feel good this morning.
I didn't realize the offensive rating was lower than any game last season. Mm-hmm. Any game? Mm-hmm.
Any game.
I guess the Cooper flag point guard experiment of the PJ Washington Cooper backcourt, you know, whatever. Not a great first start there. What was behind that, those offensive struggles, Kirk? Was it as simple as saying that Victor Wembanyama made Anthony Davis look like, you know, he's 6 foot tall and just swallowed him at the rim? Or what was behind those struggles offensively for Dallas?
Well, the thing about basketball is after 100 plus years, we have a pretty good idea of how it's played. And despite the advent of the concept of positionless basketball, you still need players who can actually do things on the floor within certain skill sets. The Mavericks don't really have players who are excellent passers or who are excellent ball handlers that can drive and set up an offense. They essentially fielded a team to start the game last night of four forwards and a shooting guard who is no longer capable of creating off the dribble. It was as ugly as you can imagine, because they're also throwing in this wrinkle of a Jay Triano handoff offense where it's sound and fury signifying nothing. They just sort of flip the ball to each other and there was nowhere to go. And Wembanyama is obviously a massive part of that. He just sort of closes off, let's just say 60% of the floor by putting his arms up. But it was worse than that, because even when he was off the floor, the offense was terrible. And Jason Kidd said after the game something to the effect of, I have the quote here, "We didn't have trouble. We just didn't pass the ball." And I don't know what to do about that. Like, it's basketball. It's just such an embarrassing quote at an embarrassing performance. Like, losing by 33 points on national television on opening night should be causing an existential crisis within this organization. Because I don't see ways that they get better. Because as much as I value Victor Wembanyama's performance last night, he was amazing. Outside of him and Stephon Castle, it's not like they're loaded for bear. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the Spurs definitely look like a far more competent team. I mean, like, they, like, Champagne, solid player. Barnes, solid. Keldon Johnson, solid. Dylan Harper, very good off the bench. So, like, there's a lot of solid around Victor at this point, who now looks like, I mean, through one game, Victor Wembanyama is the MVP. Through one game. Not saying a lot, but through one game, he is. But for the Dallas side, I think your point about the lack of lanes for them to be significantly better, that is the worrisome side of things here for Dallas. With that said, though, Kirk, I mean, it is Cooper's debut. You know, he has 10 points on 4 of 13, 10 rebounds. He'll get better over the course of time. At some point, Kyrie will come back. Like, Klay Thompson's not going to be 1 of 5 from 3 every single night. I think there are ways in which this team could be better. Even D'Lo coming off the bench, he's 1 for 6 in the game, played only 15 minutes. Like, he'll have better games. So I think there are some paths of improvement for Dallas. But to your point, there's a limitation with the way this team is built, especially as loaded as the Western Conference is. I didn't pick this team to make the playoffs. I don't think they will make the playoffs. I think they're going to be one of those good teams that's on the outside looking in. But ultimately, it just looks like San Antonio has surpassed them because of what Victor has become. And other teams could also have surpassed them as well. So Nico Harrison's vision of, we'll prove everybody wrong, defense wins championships, we're going to win it all, that is probably just going to end up looking like a really, really silly statement from him of all the silly things he's already done already.
I mean, I think so. There's obviously elements for cleanup. The part that frustrated me more than anything else is I know it can take time for team defenses to gel, and I certainly expect the Mavericks to get better in that regard. But even past Victor Wembanyama, they were getting blown by just about everyone who could dribble. You had Castle, you had Harper. I mean, the points in the paint, we didn't even touch on this, man. Did you see the points in the paint differential?
Oh, it's enormous.
68 to 26.
Crazy.
A Mavericks team with all forwards giving up 68 points in the paint is simply unforgivable. And they're going to need to figure out how to stay in front of guys who can put the ball on the floor. Wembanyama is obviously really difficult in that regard, but they weren't able to stay in front of anyone all night long. And it was really quite embarrassing where there were numerous instances where you could see some of the Mavs forwards almost block hunting, where they would be okay with a guy getting past them only to try to go for a block. And it's like NBA players are good at finishing. They know how to use the rim in their defense, and they can make plays from all different angles. And I was just very frustrated watching that because it belied a lack of effort. And that's one thing that I can at least say about Jason Kidd teams since he's been the Dallas Mavericks coach is they always play hard. And this team gave up minutes into the second half, and that was just pretty disgusting.
What were your first impressions of Cooper Flagg?
A little over his skis, so to speak. I don't think playing him at point guard was fair to him.
I agree.
I think he possesses an offensive capacity to do probably just about anything he puts his mind to, given enough time and training. But at this point in his career, he's a play finisher, not a play initiator. And he got a little bit behind in the count. And at one point, he was 1 of 8 from the floor. I seriously doubt we will ever see a game this season where Flagg starts 1 of 8. He passed up some early looks in the first half, which I think the Mavericks coaching staff probably told him at the halftime, like, stop screwing around, shoot the ball. But what you did see from him was the kind of relentlessness and the effort. He did get lost in the shuffle at times, but that's just because the offense was a little bit ugly. I expect great things from him, but that game certainly wasn't indicative of what he might be. I mean, he did finish with a double-double, but, you know, very inefficient on offense and, you know, not much of a defensive stat stuffing of the box score either. You know, he had that one steal to open the game and then nothing for the rest of the game. And during summer league, during his season at Duke, he was really good at getting stocks, and that's just something I expect to see more of as the season goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's spot on. The first thing you said, 100% true. It's a bit unfair to him. He's playing in a position he shouldn't be playing in. He shouldn't be a quote-unquote point guard, as they're calling him. It's not. He's a play finisher, not a play creator at this point of his career. It's literally day one of his career. But even at Duke, he was more finisher than he was creator. He did a bit of that. I don't want to like take that away from him off the dribble with what he can do. But as a rookie, when he was drafted, Kirk, I said, or rather when the Mavericks won the lottery, I said that I feel bad for Cooper in this fit because A, the situation, the fan base is just distraught. They lost Luka. A lot of them have left the team. It's an ugly situation. They get a terrible GM. It's a team that should be trying to build young, but they're trying to win. I didn't like it for that reasons. I did not expect that he'd be playing point guard on opening night. And that's another thing where it's like this could be something that helps him grow through mistakes. But at the same time, like, you want to position young players to succeed. And it just did not feel like in this game he was put in a position to succeed. And ultimately, I wonder, when does the shift happen? Does Jason Kidd at some point say, okay, D'Lo, we're putting the ball in your hands? Does Ryan Nemhard, as an undrafted guy in a two-way contract who is a true throwback point guard and did play fairly well in his debut. Does he get more opportunity just to be a pure point for this team? And I just think at some point that's going to happen. It's just a matter of when, and then Cooper Flagg will be in a better position, hopefully winning games, playing his proper role. But opening night, I don't even understand why they started the season off this way. It's just weird to me.
I don't either. And the fact that Ryan Nemhard played in the first half, a second round draft pick who is currently on a two-way contract, meaning the Mavericks at most can use him for 50 regular season games. He got opening night minutes. That speaks to the concern that the coaching staff has from the point guard position, or just from the guard position generally. It's very frustrating to watch. Because it seems to me that early on, head coach Jason Kidd doesn't have any or doesn't have enough confidence in D'Angelo Russell to play him. And Charles Barkley sort of went in on the Mavericks at halftime. It's like, you know, get a guard, play a guard. This is what I mean with my kind of opening rant, where it's like, we know how basketball is played, and you just can't wish for the five players on the floor to have the skill sets that you need. You need to be able to space the floor. You need to be able to put the ball on the ground and get to the basket. And the Mavericks just didn't have anybody that could do that. Wembanyama was obviously a problem, but that was really an extreme example. Now, the one thing the Mavericks have working for them here is their opening 20 games are pretty soft. They play their next two games are the Wizards in Toronto. They play the Wizards again in their first 20 games. They play New Orleans. They play a kind of a Memphis team, which I'm not high on, a Phoenix Suns team. They have enough chances in these first 20 games to build something, to establish kind of a team, some team momentum, and get things going in a positive direction. But just when you get beat by 33 points on opening night, it has to call into question all of your process and all that you were hoping for.
Yeah, I think so too. And look, they are going to get some wins. They're going to be a competitive team. I don't want to take that away. But the process part is odd. You mentioned inside the NBA, Kirk. It was like they didn't leave. It seemed great. You know, it was like they didn't go.
That's a sigh of relief. Anybody that watches basketball night to night has criticisms of the broadcast crews and the halftime shows. You just watch this stuff so much, and it's really easy to find fault. And it was nice to see that the transition was smooth, that ESPN gave these guys enough time to talk. That was, I think, what most people were worried about, that they would cut to commercial and things like that. It was fun to see. I like being mad at Shaq, who just is sort of like poo-pooing Wembanyama's performance. Like, come on, buddy. 40 points is amazing. Like, at one point in time, Wembanyama had 40 points. The Mavericks had 82. Like, let's not shake it and just, like, act like that's no big deal. Like, it was amazing.
Spike Eskin will be on the podcast later on, and I know he asked me to ask him about Victor Wembanyama, so I'm sure he has something to say as well about that. But you're right about inside the NBA. It's nice to have them just being themselves, and they had the freedom to speak, and I think they're leaning into it as well. Like they had that graphic on screen with Charles, you know, schedule for Thursday when he's going to do Pat McAfee and the Ocho and going to do Get Up and NFL Live. It was like pretty funny how they kind of leaned into it with ESPN. So who knows? Like, it could, who knows? Inside the NBA, new life, new network. It could be new types of jokes, bringing on different types of people. Like, it could kind of breathe new life into the show potentially. So overall, though, this week, Kirk, you know, NBA on NBC did a good job in their debut. I especially liked the play-by-play. I thought that was excellent. The broadcast of the game itself was very good. And then inside the NBA, felt like inside the NBA, just on ESPN instead of TNT. And so a good week for the NBA so far. I look forward to seeing how Amazon is. You know, Amazon will be very interesting. I like the people that they hire.
Amazon's the one. That's the one I'm the most hopeful for. I think they have the most people associated with their broadcast that are going to talk about the game with that blend of love of basketball with like analytical skill. My guy, Dirk Nowitzki, is, I think, going to be an absolute superstar on that. You know, it's funny. He came to this country with English as a second language, and he recently told D Magazine in a long interview that he now thinks in English and sometimes struggles with German. So I'm just really looking forward to him talking about basketball regularly. It's going to be great.
I mean, that's going to be Blake Griffin, Taylor Rooks. I'm forgetting somebody in that pregame configuration they have going on. But
right, because Dwayne Wade's going to be doing play by play, right? Like the yes. commentary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And so, but like Blake is funny. Dirk has mm-hmm. a sense of humor as well. Taylor is great in her role at facilitating and picking her spots as well. So I look forward to seeing those Amazon games. Kirk, appreciate you joining me today, man. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
You can find my podcast on anywhere you can get it. YouTube. It's called Pod Maverick. I've also joined a new venture called Offside. It's a company where I'm going to be making videos alongside folks like Jason Concepcion, Mo DeKeel, and Kofi. It's a short form video platform. I'd really appreciate if you'd follow that at Join Offside on Twitter. You can get early access to the app. It's going to be coming soon. You can follow us on IG or TikTok. It's really something that I'm having a great time doing because, as you can tell, I enjoy yelling about sports. And it's, you know, 90 seconds to 2 minute videos about sports. And it's just it's the way people are consuming content now. And you can find me there. I'd really appreciate it if you gave us a follow there. And Mavs Moneyball, where I do a lot of writing and attempts at writing. you know how it is. Writing's a bit of a lost art at this point, but I still love writing about basketball and covering basketball. And I'm just so excited that the season is back, even though my team got demolished by 33 points.
Kirk, I appreciate you joining me. I hope we don't hear your name during this Cash Patel presser announcing Chauncey Billups and Terry Rozier. I hope I don't hear Kirk Anderson, but if it was, it's good knowing you. All right, thanks again to Kirk for joining me. We had some massive news on Thursday morning that dropped with some arrests around the NBA, focus on different gambling rings that were happening. Terry Rozier was arrested. Chauncey Billups, head coach of the Blazers. Former NBA player Damon Jones was as well. And the FBI revealed that the Hornets, Lakers, Raptors, Blazers were the teams associated with these separate different gambling rings that were happening around the league. It's kind of crazy. We've obviously heard about, you know, Malik Beasley earlier in the year, Terry Rozier as well. Pablo Torre had a podcast with Tom Haverstraw, Yahoo's own, earlier this year, talking about some of these things that have now since been revealed. And Ben Fox over at Yahoo did point out on social this very important distinction to make between the charges against Billups and Rozier here. As he wrote, the Rozier case relates to inside information for sports betting and NBA prop bets. The Billups case relates to attracting people to play in rigged poker games. So they are not connected, those two, but it overall relates to what Cash Patel, head of the FBI, said was over 30 arrests that happened. We don't know every name quite yet, but 30 arrests that happened to gambling, illegal gambling involving athletes. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear the details here, especially with the Billups and Damon Jones one here, because they use these luring tactics where they had these, they called them fish, these wealthy victims that they brought in. And then they had the appeal of playing with professional athletes at the time, Chauncey Billups and Damon Jones. And every participant at the table, other than the victims, the dealers, the players, the face cards for these poker games, were in on the scam. And it was this really allegedly complex scheme with advanced wireless technology and different tools that they use, hidden cameras, x-ray contact lenses and eyeglasses that could detect pre-marked cards on there, hidden cameras that were watching what was happening, watching the trays to read the cards. And so I know they had mentioned during the presser that there was these card shufflers they had that were modified that could scan the decks, could predict hands and send data to an offsite operator. And that info was then relayed to the quarterback in the room who signaled to the people in on it. And so sounds obviously incredibly serious. And you wonder what this means for obviously these 30 people who are arrested. And in the short term, from a pure basketball standpoint, for the Portland Trailblazers who played on Thursday night, they lost their game 118-114. Billups could be out. you know, Rozier may never play a game again. We, as of recording at 11:21 a.m. Eastern, we haven't yet heard if Malik Beasley has been arrested. You know, we don't know there. We don't know all the names quite yet, but opening week of the NBA season, not just about the exciting basketball on the floor, but also about this crazy, crazy thing that's happening off the floor. The one thing so far is it seems like Billups was not involved with anything during his career as a coach. That would obviously be a massive scandal. But again, we don't know every detail here quite yet. Of course, we'll talk about it on the podcast as we learn more. Let's talk a little bit more about the basketball we saw on Wednesday night with Spike Eskin talking about the Sixers and Celtics game. All right, now joining me to talk about the Sixers and Celtics and VJ Edgecombe scoring 34 in his debut from the rights to Ricky Sanchez, Spike Eskin. Spike, how you doing?
Hi, KOC. I'm feeling a little bit of deja vu, as if we just did this.
I know, for real. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm feeling good, man. I am feeling good. Very happy to be here with you today. Thank you for having me.
I know. Likewise, man. Always good to have you on. I got my Spike Eskin is a liar shirt
on.
I'm always going to wear it every single appearance as long as I remember. So VJ Edgecombe scores 34 points in his debut. Now tied third all time for a rookie in their debut. Wilt Chamberlain ranks first. He surpassed Allen Iverson, who had 30 in his debut with the Sixers back in the 90s. Five three-pointers, 13 of 26 from the floor, 7 boards, 3 assists. VJ Edgecombe, Spike, he looked like a star.
Dude, we have hope again in Philadelphia. You know, it was such a dark year last year. You know, we've been doing the podcast for 12 and a half years now, right? And this is, believe it or not, like with all the bad things that have happened, I think last year was the darkest time. And to get that third pick was so exciting, you know, but everybody wanted, it's funny when you look at the lottery party, everybody wanted one of the top two and we got the third, right? Then we get Edgecombe. And everybody, we all talk ourselves into it. And he seems like a great kid. It seems like a great athlete and had some really cool moments in the preseason and summer league. But I don't think any of us saw a debut like that coming, specifically offensively from him. You know, his shot doesn't look broken or anything, but, you know, you could tell when he was missing, he wasn't missing by a half an inch when he was missing shots in the preseason. So I think, I think one thing I learned last night, I think the shot will come and go this year, but he looked so calm in high pressure situations. I thought it was really notable that when it was him and Grimes on the floor, that Nurse had Edgecombe as the primary ball handler, which is not something I thought he would do. He just looked, he made good decisions, you know, like just from a pump fake to a drive to finding Oubre in the corner, something that it doesn't seem like much, but for a 19-year-old to do in his first game in a high pressure situation was really good. So I think we're all really, really excited. And it was the best thing about the last 12, 13 years of doing this has been the moments where you have hope for the future, right? Like when you see flashes of what could be. And last night was an amazing moment for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think ultimately when you look at the Sixers, obviously we'll talk about Joel Embiid in a second, but Tyrese Maxey with 40, Jared McCain had a great rookie season before he got hurt, and then VJ Edgecombe. Morey has hit on a lot of picks, on a lot of these decisions that he's made around the core of the roster with the veterans who have been there since before he was. And it seems like Edgecombe, like you said, he goes third. It's all about Cooper Flagg and Dylan Harper, first and second, but VJ Edgecombe, there was an element of safety. Like you feel like a guy as athletic as he is with his skill set, he'll be at least a solid rotation guy, but there's a chance he becomes a star. And he had a big preseason game, a big debut, and now you're looking at a guy who it's like, okay, maybe he's ahead of schedule and his long-term star potential. And during preseason, I said, Spike, how I felt like VJ Edgecombe was the most important rookie in the NBA because of the impact he can make on the Sixers in the short term, especially given how weak the Eastern Conference is. I felt like VJ could raise the ceiling of this team. Do you think you've seen enough from VJ, not just in his debut, but preseason included, to feel like he could change the fortunes this particular season from the Sixers?
Sure. I guess I just, I think no matter what this season is, he changes the fortune of this season, right? I like, okay, let's say Embiid ends up being fine and Paul George ends up being fine. He provides something that the Sixers have really never had, is just whether he is a second or a third guard, just a really great athlete, a really solid perimeter defender, somebody as a guard who can even rebound, who can, I know it sounds amateur, but to dunk on people, you know, like we've had so many groundbound players over the last several years as they invest in veterans, you know, to try to win and to see somebody like this. So I think if they are really, if they end up being good and a contender this year, having somebody like him will be a major help, right? Because he doesn't, especially with McCain back and the way that Maxey shoots, is that I think you could put him in a position to only highlight what he's already good at. But I think also if the year falls apart, I think he can be a way to bring the year together almost, or for there to be purpose. There was no purpose to last year after George and Embiid got hurt. There was nothing. The only purpose was losing. But now, if they don't come around, the purpose this year is, wow, look at the exciting young guy and young core we have. So I think he raises the ceiling of them as a team, but I also think for a fan, he raises the ceiling of the team as a relevant thing to watch or care about, if that makes sense.
Makes total sense in the world, because it's the type of thing where if Embiid, I mean, his 4 points on 1 of 9 and his debut didn't look great at all physically, if things don't turn around for him, there's still plenty of reasons for hope and optimism considering the other guys on the team. And it's not just Maxey, McCain, and Edgecombe either. Like, I think like Dominic Barlow looked really good in his debut with the Sixers. So it's like there's these other youngish guys on the team where you feel like there's something to build around. And ultimately, though, for the potential of the team this year, though, Embiid's got to be Joel Embiid at least 80%, 75% of his peak level. And 4 points on 1 of 9 in his debut, didn't finish the game, not really jumping at all. Spike, what are we to make of Joel Embiid's first game of the season?
It was pretty disconcerting, I think. There are really two camps in Philly, the people who have given up and just want them gone and don't want to look at them anymore. And there's the people who still have hope. And I think if you're the former, you look at last night and there's a very easy, told you so, he's cooked, he doesn't have anything left. If you are the latter, you saw the preseason game where he moved fine and he played fine. And he, when I say fine, I mean better than fine. He had, I know preseason stats don't matter, but he had, you know, in 16 minutes or something, he had 14, 8, and 7. He was passing the ball well. He was moving pretty well on defense. I think last night, the thing that was most troubling was the difference how he looked physically preseason game to that game. He's had games where he hasn't shot well, right? I mean, if he had gone 1 for 9 last night, but moved well on defense and rebounded and passed the ball well, I wouldn't have cared. The 1 for 9, he's a good shooter. He'll be able to shoot. I think the thing that worried me most was he just looked like he couldn't move laterally on defense. I don't know if he's scared, you know, troubled with the knee, if he doesn't want to get hurt, what it is. Maybe it's just rust, but it didn't look like rust. It looked like a guy who looked closer to the bad part of last year than pre-Kuminga injury. I don't think any of us were hoping that or had any illusions that he would look physically the way he did 5 years ago or 6 years ago, but if he could look the way that he did when I say Kuminga injury, when he fell on his knee, pre-knee injury from 2 years ago, I think that's all they need. And he didn't look like that. Like, he looked like the guy that we saw in the Olympics, you know, or the guy that we saw in that Knicks series. And I don't know, that's tough, you know?
I had two thoughts watching the game, because I watched his game against Minnesota in the preseason where he looked really good. One of them was how much of that is the nature of Minnesota's offense, where he doesn't have to face a five out offense like you see in Boston with all the space and motion and shooting that Boston uses versus Minnesota, which is a bit more stagnant of an offense in the half court. However, like, I don't think it's just that. I just feel like if you just look at him, if you isolate the camera on Joel Embiid, he looked like he was moving a lot more gingerly in this game than he was in that preseason game, which makes like your mind wander. Is it like, was it a setback? Is it the type of thing where he wakes up each morning feeling differently, or was it like an actually some type of setback. All I know is like if I picked the Sixers to, I think, finish the 4 or 5 seed, and we'll see. It's a long road ahead in the year, but it was scary, man. It was scary. And that camp of Sixers supporters that you're saying are just done with them, they want to move on and have an eye towards the future. Like they it feels like they have a lot of evidence suddenly behind them just after this first game. It was concerning, to say the least.
Yeah, I think that the only thing I always say to those people is there's nothing to do now. Like the only action item now is keep throwing them out there and see if it works its way out. You know, one of the things that they said last year,
you're not getting anything for him either, Spike. Like you're not, right, you're not getting anything.
Paying to get off him. Yeah, yes. You're paying to get off him probably at this point with that contract there. So just throw him out there. And the only thing I'd add is that, you know, last year, one of the things they said repeatedly was before he had that surgery, which was a minor surgery, was that the condition in his knee, he's going to need to play on it more for it to settle in. So maybe he just needs to play on it more. Like he played that preseason game. The next practice they had, he was a full participant, did everything. They said everything was fine, was not listed on the injury report yesterday. So it would be the first time that an injury situation was misreported in Philadelphia. But I think if I want to look at it positively, or at least realistically, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you're not going to sit him. You're just going to keep putting him out there until he can't physically anymore and see if it works, because the other side of that is what you said is using a draft pick to get rid of him. And then for what, you know? So you just wait and you pray, I guess.
Yeah, I think ultimately Philly, it's pretty obvious what they have to do. They have to keep him, hope he gets better, and continue. Like, you still have hope with these other guys as part of the future right now. And for the Celtics side of that, they blow that game. They just felt like one of those, you know, middling teams that are going to be competitive but lose a lot of games in the fourth quarter. And it's another Missoula special with a blown lead there for him. But ultimately, I picked the Celtics to sneak into the playoffs as an 8 seed in my predictions before opening night. But I ultimately think the best scenario for the Celtics is to miss the playoffs, have a lottery pick. And was there any better example than what we saw on the other side with Philadelphia landing VJ Edgecombe? Like, especially this year for Boston, that is the prize, to win the lottery, end up with a top 3 pick, and then add a guy to Tatum, Brown, and the core going back next season. So I think for the Celtics, ultimately losing is winning this season at the end of the day. But what did you see from the Boston side of things? Do you feel like they are a potential playoff team, or did you come away feeling like this team's going to be in the lottery for sure?
So before I watched them, I thought, oh, they're going to make the playoffs. My doomer mentality was they're going to make the playoffs as a 7 seed. Tatum's going to come back at the beginning of March. And all of a sudden, as a 7 seed or an 8 seed, they're going to end up in the Eastern Conference Finals, because systemically, they just know how to play. They have athletes, blah, blah, blah. That was my thought before watching them. When you actually watch them, you think to yourself, man, there's a lot of guys on this team that aren't like the level of player that you're used to seeing on the Celtics. I think you got so used to watching the Celtics with such a stacked roster of players, then to see it basically be just Derek White and Jaylen Brown, and like other guys that they're fine, can play, but it just doesn't look like the same thing. It was actually kind of stunning. I think they could be in the playoffs because I just don't think there's a number of good Eastern Conference teams. You know, they could, I mean, did a team make the playoffs last year, or at least made the play-in, winning 35 games or something like that? I think they could sneak in. And I do think they have a pretty good coach, and Jaylen Brown looked pretty good last night, but they had more players that were not Celtics level players, I thought, playing last night than I'm used to watching.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, especially given all the guys that they did lose. And look, I think that's a game that if you're Boston and you feel like you have a chance to make the playoffs, you have to beat the Sixers with Joel Embiid scoring 4 points on 1 of 9. Just like you have to get those wins.
And the other thing is, it was kind of stunning looking. I mean, not having McCain and George will fill out that roster, but you look at the Sixers starting lineup. There's only one reliable shooter in the whole starting lineup. Like they started Maxey, Edgecombe, Oubre, Dominic Barlow, and Joel Embiid. Like the only reliable shooter there is Maxey. You know, Embiid can shoot all those things, but Oubre's not a shooter. Edgecombe we'll see. Barlow can't shoot at all. And so it was, you know, I went into it. It felt kind of like a process game, you know? So you go against that team with Embiid, like you said, scoring 4 points. You should probably win that game at home. They're 5.5 point favorite last night. So, yeah, I agree with you.
As a Joel Embiid guy, Spike, I am curious your thoughts on Victor Wembanyama last night.
Well, okay. So two things can be true. I will say two things are true. Thing number one, he was great last night. Super impressive. Thing number two, he's 7'7". He runs like a gazelle. He runs like a small forward. He is a foot taller than every other person he's playing. When you include his reach, he's probably got 2 extra feet of, like, Victor, to me, given his physical advantages, Victor Wembanyama should score 50 points a game and win 5 titles, and they should never miss the playoffs. Like, it should be like Wilt. I'm being serious. When you think of the difference between Wilt physically and the rest of the league, you're like, oh, that's why he scored 50 points a game. Like, that's why he scored 100 points, because he was just so physically dominant. And I see Wemby trying to cross people over and shoot 3-pointers. Dude, you can dunk standing at the free throw line. You should, like, every game should be, he should shoot 37 of 42 and plus his free throws. And is what he's doing
37 of 42, Spike?
dude, here's the thing. Everybody is like, I want to keep it clean. Is Yahoo. I don't even know how to. Everyone is so happy with his 40 and 15 last night. Put him on the list of 7,000 other NBA players who have had 40 and 15 in a game. It's not that impressive to me. He's in the third year of his career. They haven't made the playoffs. Like, he's 7'7", and everybody's excited that he's 7'7" and shooting threes. Hello. Like, if I was playing against people who are 4 feet tall, all I would do would be stand around the rim and dunk every single ball and do this to people, right? Like, what are we talking about? He should be scoring 50 points a game. Otherwise, I'm not impressed. 40 and 15. I don't know. How many times did Russell Westbrook get 40 and 15? And he's a pariah. I'm just not impressed. It should be 50 points every game. I'm being completely serious. I look at him physically and I think to myself, if he does not reinvent the NBA with his dominance, he is a disappointment.
Well, what if this is the beginning of that, Spike? Year three, he scores only 40 in his debut. Because here's the difference. I feel like the difference between Wemby right now and really his rookie year and last year too, the teammates have realized who he is. Like, they are getting him the ball more often. There's some more post-ups with Wemby. You saw the one dribble he had getting around Anthony Davis for the reverse dunk and one. You saw that, him getting to the rim with
how many times has Giannis done that? What are we talking about here? Giannis did, and he's 6'10". He's 7'7". He's 7'7". Everyone brags before the season. Oh, he grew 2 inches. Then why is anyone ever guarding you? Why are you ever missing a shot? I'm sorry. It is not that impressive.
He made AD look like a G leaguer.
AD is, he's on the back nine. AD moves like I do. I'm just saying, he may be the thing that you're talking about. He may end up being that. But 40 and 15 for him, given his physical advantages, would, if I played against third graders and I got 40 and 15, would you be that impressed? Of course not. The difference between him physically and every other, you're talking about a Dembona, right? A Dembona is 6'9". What should it, like, Vic Embiid scored 70 on Victor Wembanyama. It happened. It's 70. Don't talk to me about 40 points. Don't talk to me about 40 points. I don't care. When 8 MVPs, win 5 championships, score 50 points a game, then I will be impressed by Victor Wembanyama.
Maybe that's what's coming. But I'll tell you maybe what. Maybe it 40 in a blowout over Dallas on opening night. I bet you he scores 50 this season. Maybe he scores 60. And maybe at that point, I'll have
every game.
I think he should. I think he should too, especially considering the KG comp, where he's like a hybrid of KD and Shaq. Like, at times, he does look like that hybrid, a KD Giannis type of hybrid. If that is indeed what happens, he will have a game where he scores 60 this year, and maybe a game where he scores 70. It very well could happen if it's a close, tightly contested game.
KOC, he should have 5 games in a row that he scores 60. He's 7-7. What if Manute Bol was good? Like, this is like if Sean Bradley was actually good, right? I mean, it should be impossible. It should be, teams should want to give up. Players should want to retire because of Wemby.
You know what you sound like to me? It's probably the way Hawks fans hear me when I used to talk about Trae Young saying, oh, 30 and 12 isn't enough.
Yeah.
He also needs to do these things.
Yep.
He also can, you just have higher expectations for Wemby than anybody else. That's all it is. You see more. You see more than 40 and 15. Yeah.
Yes,
you
just see
more greatness.
Yes. You don't want to let good be the enemy of great. Like he is good right now, but I've seen 40 and 15. VJ Ezcum just played in his first game. He scored 34. I'm supposed to care that Wemby in his third year scored 40? Who cares? He's 7-7.
Spike, that's such a good take. And honestly,
Maxey scored 40 last night. He's 6 feet tall.
Spike, you're not wrong about that. That is a statement of facts. Thank you so much for joining me today, man.
You got it. Thanks for having me, buddy.
You can find Spike at the Rights to Ricky Sanchez. He hosts afternoons on WIP. Thank you, Spike.
Thanks, dude.
That was great, man. Thank you. Take two is even better. Take two is
yeah.
Wow.
There you go. Emmy, do you just want me to, I'll put this audio file on Google Drive and send it to you. Does that work? Okay.
Thank you so much, Spike. That Wemby take is so good.
Yeah, I love the Wemby take. Thank you for letting me do it. Mike just rolls his eyes at me, but you will let me do it. So I appreciate it. It was awesome.
And you're not wrong. You're not wrong either. That's the thing.
It's not a crazy take.
The best takes are rooted in truth. Thank you, Spike. Yep. Appreciate it, man.
Yep. All right. See you, man.
Thank you again to Spike Esser for joining me. We did get some other news. Kristaps Porzingis and his mystery illness was finally revealed, the thing that plagued him the whole end of his Celtics tenure. He said to The Athletic that he had POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And what that is a condition that dramatically increases a patient's heart rate when they stand up. And so he said like his heart rate could be normal when he was laying down, when he was horizontal, and then he would stand up and it would shoot up immediately to 130 beats per minute. He had no energy because of it. So hopefully Kristaps is all over that. It sounds pretty serious. It's kind of still so strange how it took so long for them to diagnose that. But it does sound like it's very, very rare in a guy for, 7'3", 7'4", whatever his actual height is, to have something like that. Just, it seems like all these super tall dudes have these weird medical things that happen. So hopefully Kristaps is able to stay healthy. The Hawks did lose opening night. Very disappointing game for them, 138-118. Hopefully he didn't pass it along to all of his teammates because that was a bummer performance for Atlanta on opening night against Toronto. So I think for the Hawks, they should have better games. I was pretty high on what they could be. Everybody seemed to be high on the Hawks. A disappointing game for them, especially a team like Toronto, that weird roster. They look great on opening night. I'll talk more about that game and those teams in the weeks to come. Hopefully have some Hawks and Raptors people on. But today, we're going to talk about the Knicks and the Cavaliers with Jonathan Macri from Knicks Film School. That's coming up right now. All right, now joining me to discuss the Knicks opening night win over the Cleveland Cavaliers from Knicks Film School. Jonathan, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. A little bit of a scratchy voice. I promise that was not all from screaming at my television last night, seeing, Knicks Twitter's wet dream come true right there on the screen in front of me. But yeah, I'm doing good. It was a good night, an opening night win. What could you ask for?
I mean, you said it like Knicks fans seem just overjoyed this morning. Like you said, their wet dream come true. Why is that? What did we see in that opening night win that has made Knicks fans so happy?
I mean, it's impossible for me to answer that question without referring to the previous head coach, Tom Thibodeau. And it's funny right now in Knicks land, there's like a very big sentiment of like, look, could we please just move on? The Thibodeau era is over. Do we have to continue talking about this? And yet, to properly answer that question, the only way to explain why what we saw last night was so impactful to so many people was to compare it to what we had been seeing previously. So for one, 11 guys playing in the game, 6 guys getting off the bench. And we're not talking token minutes here. We're talking Trey Jemison III, who, you know, kudos to any of your listeners who like are fully familiar with his career and resume in the NBA. Like, he's on a two-way here with the Knicks. He got 8 minutes and they were good, impactful minutes. So there's just the numbers game. And then there's how they played, which I'm sure we're going to get into more. But it was, you know, dare I say, unrecognizable from how we've seen this team look for really like the last 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely did look unrecognizable. Just the amount of motion and movement on offense. And I mean, the on-ball picks by Brunson, he had 5 on-ball picks. And obviously, he's not setting like hard screens, but being able to like slip out of those. He had 5 on-ball picks against the Cavs. He averaged one per game last season. And so it just feels like there's more fluidity to the offense, more pace. I was a little bit concerned with the overall pace in preseason. Maybe there's a bit of an overreaction compared to how quickly they were getting into their actions. But it looked like things were clicking very, very well against Cleveland with Brunson into his new role. I'm curious what you thought about that balance between him on ball and off ball.
I mean, I thought it. So clearly you saw last night it was a work in progress. There was a stretch in the third quarter. Donovan Mitchell was going off. And as like should surprise no one, Brunson is like, okay, it's my time to answer back. And there was kind of like a handful of possessions there where it was more of what we, you know, became accustomed to seeing the last few years. And, you know, he didn't have his shot last night, but that's neither here nor there. Brunson kind of usually starts a little bit slowly. But there were also a lot of moments where you saw him really embracing what Mike Brown wants him to do. I said it as we were watching. The very first 2 possessions of the game, you saw Jalen Brunson space to the corner. And one of them resulted in a wide open catch and shoot 3 for him. Another one resulted in a hard closeout that he got Cat a great look from 3 that he was fouled on and got to the line. So I think there was a mix of both. I think it's going to be a process. And then I think the real question, and you pointed it out already, is the pace thing. Can they continue to play fast? My guy, Fred Katz of The Athletic, we were talking the other day about how, the pace numbers were low in the preseason, but they're getting into their first action very quickly. And I thought you saw that again last night, and it was in part because it was not just Jalen Brunson bringing the ball up. I mean, we saw Mikal Bridges, who the Knicks paid, I don't know, you know, if you remember this, they paid a decent price to get this gentleman on their basketball team. Like, he started to look like the guy that you pay that sort of a freight to acquire because he's doing all these different things, initiating actions, and it looked pretty good.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there with Bridges. He just felt like more important, more of a connective piece. He wasn't just hitting that beautiful fadeaway mid-range. He was doing more with the ball in his hands. And I think that's where the Knicks were good last season. Like, I don't want it to be like, oh, Tibbs sucks. But at the same time, like, I just felt like there was more. There's more, you know, meat on the bone with the players on the team. And when you go to Brunson over and over and over again, and we saw it when Brunson was out last year, Bridges did more, OG did more, Cat did more. All these guys are capable of doing more. And with Brunson, it's very funny to see that last season he averaged 86 touches per game. This opening night game, he had exactly 86 touches, but the big difference is everywhere else. Last season, he averaged 6 seconds per touch, 6 dribbles per touch, and he had 2.4 shots taken per game, taking no dribbles. Opening night, 86 touches, 4.7 seconds per touch, so not holding the ball as long, 4.3 dribbles per touch, so not dribbling as often, and then he had 8 shots with no dribbles, and he made only one of them, but who cares? Like, he's going to hit those shots. The usage just felt more balanced. Like, you're still going to get a ton of production and opportunities for Brunson to score. It's just the process of getting there is just going to have so much diversity to it within this Knicks offense, which I think will ultimately, you know, translate to more sustained success, different ways of scoring, and hopefully better playoff success as well.
So the dribbles per touch and the seconds per touch you just referenced, that led the league the last two seasons, I'm pretty sure. And if I'm remembering correctly, I haven't looked at the stat in a while. The gap between him and whoever was in second last year widened, over the previous year. Look, I was a Tibbs guy. I kind of became, known primarily as a Tibbs guy over the last few years because I would be so vehement in not defending every decision he made, but just kind of appreciating, like, look, the Knicks were in a wasteland for the better part of 20 years. This guy came in and he brought stability. And there's, there is a modicum of stability every night with a Thibodeau coach team that you're going to get. The trade-off of that stability is that you were constantly watching and feeling like, man, is there a ceiling here we're not reaching because we have a head coach that is so dead set on, I am not going to push anybody or anything like with terms of my system past a limit that I know what the result is going to be. And here is Mike Brown coming in and saying, no, I'm going to push guys past their limit. One name, I don't know if you mentioned in terms of, when Brunson was out, someone who took on more was OG Anunoby. He looked like an all-NBA player for a month last year. Granted, that was against a cupcake schedule. But you fast forward to last night, he has one of his 5 to 10 best games as Nick. He was a monster on the boards. He handled the ball also. Like, he brought the ball up. He initiated some actions. Did he have 4 turnovers, one of which was really more like it was worse than the previous one? Yeah. You're going to get that stuff when you empower other players besides Jalen Brunson to do more. And that comes with the territory. And it kind of makes me think of the Warriors, where obviously Mike Brown was an assistant or associate coach, whatever his title was, for several years under Steve Kerr. Like, you have to deal with that stuff. And I think if you're talking about a Knicks team that has a lot of talent and is the goal is to win a championship, you have to start trying to reach for that higher ceiling. And I think what you saw last night was the beginnings of that pursuit in action.
I think you absolutely nailed that. And the other thing Mike Brown did, and I'm very happy we saw Ariel Hakpourty start the game, because that's one of the things that I didn't like the Tibbs. We didn't see enough of it last year, was the two bigs. We didn't see it until the postseason when he's like, okay, I guess now I have to use Mitchell Robinson and Karl Anthony Towns together. Because even after Mitch returned late in the year, we saw very, very little too big. But, Hakpourty, Knicks, I know some Knicks fans really like him. Like, he's not going to talk about him as like a big, needle mover, but he's solid. And I just wish we saw some of that last year. So I was encouraged that in a game Mitchell Robinson was out, Mike Brown stuck with the plan of two bigs and he started him, because I think there's benefits to playing that way defensively, offensively too, but especially defensively. What did you see from the two big lineup on opening night against Cleveland, besides the fact they made Jared Allen look absolutely tiny and small, overall?
What is it when Jared Allen sees, is it just when he sees Nick uniforms, or is it when uniforms in MSG? I mean,
the lights were brighter than I expected.
I think he had 4 rebounds last night, rebounds. And like the Knicks were missing arguably their best 2 pound for pound rebounders in Mitchell Robinson and Josh Hart. Look, I like Hakpourty. I think he has an interesting skill set. You would know more than me because you do more draft stuff, but would he have fallen to the 58th pick if there weren't some injury concerns there? Because I know he had been dealing with some stuff over a few years. Regardless of whether he would have or not, there are actually some things, and I love Mitch, to be very clear, and Mitch is arguably the best offensive rebounder in the sport, impeccable with pick and roll coverage, which is an area that Hakpourty, we saw him struggle on a few possessions on last night. But with Hakpourty in the game, you could actually use him in some ways on offense that I don't know, even in this Mike Brown era of pushing players to their limits. Like, Ariel Hakpourty delivered a pass to a cutting Jalen Brunson that he had to kind of thread a needle because there was a Cavalier defender in pursuit. Brunson missed, a semi-contested layup. It was a good look. But that's not a pass that Mitchell Robinson throws, and Hakpourty kind of has that little jump hook, little floater that Mobley got him on one time last night. But like, he could do some stuff. To the larger point about Mike Brown going to the double bigs, I think this is actually a point of contention in Knicks fandom right now. The notion, like, how much do you need to go five out with Cat to open up the offense, because like if you have the right big next to him that brings their own level of gravity, and like again going back to Mitch obviously he's not a floor spacer, he's taken 10 shots in his career outside of like 4 feet, but he has gravity, you know. And if you use Huck Porty in a certain way, you know, as a hub on offense, you know, maybe similar to as how you use Isaiah Hartenstein, he's not as good as Hartenstein obviously, but in that way, can you access some of that five out stuff without actually going to five out? I think that's going to be worth monitoring throughout the year, because especially since like Josh Hart is going to come back, and I like last night they played I think 26 minutes without either Huck Porty or Trey Jemison on the floor. That's not going to happen when Hart's back. It's just it can't. So they're going to have to figure out a way to continue to open up the offense again without a true five out look.
Now, Karl Anthony Towns had a quote earlier this week before the season began where he was asked about his role and he couldn't really describe it. And I saw that quote and I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying. This is worrisome. And maybe I overreacted a little bit to that, but you kind of like, you know, looked at jarred when I just mentioned it just now. How would you describe Cat's role, and what was behind him saying that? Is there actual confusion and Nick Land behind what he's going to be doing in that offense?
Well, so let me take a step back. Mike Brown has talked about trying to use Cat as more of a hub, similar to how he used Sabonis in Sacramento, which I think is a good idea. And he's also talking.
Well, that's why I thought it was obvious, Jonathan. I thought it was like, oh, clearly I'm going to be a hub. I'm going to dribble handoffs and I'm going to score out of these actions and I'm going to shoot. It feels like the roles should be self-explanatory, right?
It should. But we also saw, Towns in the preseason, like he did not shoot it a lot. I think he played 3 preseason games, not the whole game, a couple of them, but took 5 threes the whole preseason. And
he's having Coach Brown Cal flashbacks, going back to college. He's where I'm not going to shoot anymore.
I wish Karl Anthony Towns would take 8 threes a game, but that's never going to happen because he doesn't want to be that. But I say it time and time again. Karl Anthony Towns wants to be Kevin Durant. And I think if you want to get at the heart of maybe where those comments came from, like Brown has talked about the adjustment it's going to take for not just Towns, but all of his big men, because he requires so much of his bigs to do all these different things. And I wonder if those comments from Cat came from a place of like, you know, is this offense going to be good for me? You know, and I don't mean that that's going to come off like I'm painting Cat to be selfish. I don't want to do that. But more like Towns is the guy who's made 4 All-NBA teams in his career. In his mind, you know, justifiably, he's probably like, look, man, how I play and how I want to go about my business, that works. Like, and we've heard how he's referred to himself in the past, greatest shooting big man of all time, the whole thing. So this is not a guy who I would guess went into this season being like, all right, how can I reinvent myself? That's not, you know, I'd be surprised if that was his mentality. And it feels like Brown is asking a little bit of that. And then sure enough, in the first 3 quarters, at least last night, he wasn't really involved in the offense. Like he didn't get a lot of shots. And then he kind of found it in the 4th quarter. Jalen Brunson was off the court. He was in a 5-out look. I thought the best that we saw from Cat, interestingly enough, was a lineup with him, OG at the 4, and then Tyler Kolek. Shout out to Tyler Kolek and the Kolek Hive. I don't think the Kolek Hive has gone to sleep yet. I think they're still up on like an all-night bender. And Deuce McBride and Jordan Clarkson, and that kind of feature.
I'm in the Deuce McBride camp. I love Deuce. Always love Deuce.
Deuce is awesome.
They were great off the bench. They were really nice.
Yeah. So look, it's going to be a work in progress. I think it's for me. It's just for me. I just hope that the buy-in continues to be there. If the execution isn't there, if the results aren't there, like, God willing, the Knicks should be able to make it through 82 games on their talent alone and be a good playoff seed. But there just needs to be continued buy-in from not only Cap, but from everybody on the roster. Like, look, we're not worried about looking pretty in October and November and December, even though it looked good last night. This is about June, you know? So we'll see if that happens.
I mean, look, if Karl Anthony Towns can't see the light at the end of the tunnel with playing this role, it's just really short-sighted, because it's not like it all, like, look, Domantas Sabonis, say what you want about him as a player, of all his flaws, he's a very good player who produces, and he is, it has big nights within that ecosystem as a DHO guy. There's always a night for Sabonis because the matchup favors him. He gets shot opportunities. He gets his post opportunities. He has a mismatch. He's able to attack face up drives. Those chances would be there for Karl Anthony Towns within this ecosystem. It's not always going to be Brunson. It's not always going to be OG. It's not always going to be Bridges. It's not always going to be Deuce or Kolek having a big game off the bench, going off, getting hot. Sometimes it's going to be you as Kat in that system, where you're going to be the guy dropping 35 points. Maybe you don't have your highest average ever, but to me, if I'm Karl Anthony Towns, I'm looking at what Mike Brown did in Sacramento when it was light the beam Kings. I'm looking at what he did as an assistant with the Golden State Warriors, and I'm like, okay, this could be good for me. I can still produce, and we can win at a high level. And that's why I like that quote. It's just, I don't know, just very odd. It's just very strange to hear that coming out of him.
By the way, full disclosure, there are some in Knicks Twitter land that paint me as a Cat hater. Because you know, we're always searching for summer content, right? So we did the top 25 Knicks of the last 25 seasons, and we voted on it, our whole Knicks Film School faculty. And I was lowest on Cat. I had Cat 13th of the last 25 years, because I was like, look, it's one season. It was a really good individual season, but the playoffs kind of left me with a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth. I was just being upfront. So I don't want to sit here and what were you gonna say?
Oh, me too. I heard it from certain people after his poor playoff performances. Look, it's just the reality of it. He stunk it up. It's okay.
At times,
and he was great other times.
Yes, and he has these moments, like, you know, the shots he hit at the end of Game 4 against Detroit. His Game 1 against Indiana. I know we talked after that game. That should have gone down as one of the great Knick playoff performances of all time, and it's not even going to get remembered. So I'm saying all this to say, I don't want to like project too much from those comments. Maybe Kat was just having a bad day. The thing that I think is going to be interesting, just from a purely basketball perspective, is, and I know you know this stat, of the top 100 drivers in the league last year, nobody passed out of drives less than Karl Anthony Towns. Nobody got fewer assists out of drives than Karl Anthony Towns. And I understand that's in part because there aren't a lot of big men that drive as often as Karl Anthony Towns. And like, but still, this is a guy capable of making nice passes. We see it. So if you're going to be in that kind of triple threat position that Sabonis was often in, and you could access your face-up dribble drive game, like I would like to see him incorporate the passing part of that a little bit more. And I guess I still wonder, is it a willingness thing, or is it just like when he gets it in his head, I'm going downhill, I'm shooting this basketball. Like, is that just, that's what he's going to do, and he's not capable of doing something different? I think it's going to be a major thing that I'm going to watch out for this year.
I mean, I think that's spot on, Jonathan, because with Kat, he has the ability. I think it's either a vision thing or a willingness thing. One of the two or both. I mean, but ultimately, he has the ability, and that's where it's so exciting with what he could be within this ecosystem. And I mean, ultimately, the Knicks win that game, missing some guys against Cleveland, who also had guys missing as well. Darius Garland out for the game, and Jared Allen, just total no-shows. 28 minutes, 0 points, four rebounds. Yeah, no kidding. I mean, just... is something about MSG, is something about seeing those Knicks colors that just turns him into a 5-footer instead of a 7-footer. And I mean, if you're looking for reasons for optimism for Cleveland, it's A, we didn't have Garland. But B, I think Evan Mobley, 22 points, 8 boards, 3 assists, 4 of 8 from 3, did a lot off the dribble as well. It seemed like Mobley had an expanded game. What stood out to you from the Cleveland side of things in that game, Jonathan, for both a pessimistic and optimistic perspective?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that stood out for me was Evan Mobley. It was honestly a tale of two games. The first half, it was very clear to me, at least, that Donovan Mitchell was deferring to Evan Mobley. It's almost like he was making it a pointed effort to like, I'm going to get my guy in the MVP conversation from opening night, from Jump Street. And Donovan, I think he had 6 points at halftime or something crazy like that. Meanwhile, it was Mobley that was really like doing all the heavy lifting. And the thing that was so impressive to me, and I said it, there was a moment in the first quarter where like Mobley took a three, a top of the key, a three from the top of the arc, and it missed. And whoever was responsible, like, didn't give a hard closeout. And I said, like, man, if Mobley starts hitting those threes, the top of the arc threes, with regularity, and defenders need to start closing out hard on those, it's over. Like, he at that point, he is he's a top 10 player last season by all NBA voting. So I don't know. Does that make him a top 5 player? Like, when you combine the defense with that, I just don't know how you guard the guy. And he, sure enough, he ended up making some of those threes as the night went on. But like, I guess, and I wouldn't say this is like a negative, like the injuries obviously matter. You already have Mitchell there, who you want the ball in Mitchell's hands. Like, he's one of the best scorers in the league. If Mobley is going to take on a bigger role, and then you have Garland back, like, I don't want to say the Cavs have like there's only one ball, like, and that's a problem, but I'll be curious to see how that balance works with three guys who can legitimately, like, they could be your offensive focus at any given time. It worked great last year. They had the best offense in the history of the league. If Mobley takes another step up, does that make their lives easier, or is there maybe a bit of an adjustment period? It's something I guess I'm going to watch.
And I think that's right, spot on right there too. I think with the Cleveland, it was a conversation last year and could be an even bigger conversation this year, because there is a bit of overlap with Garland and Mitchell, and with Mobley and Allen. It would be sure nice if Jared Allen were that big tough guy who is, you know, plays hard, like rips down 12 rebounds every single night. Not that he doesn't play hard, it's just sometimes he plays soft. And I think like having that tough center next to Mobley would make more sense, since Mobley's more lean, perimeter oriented. And same with the two small guards in the backcourt. If Mobley's taking on more ball handling responsibilities, and if Mitchell is still the guy on the team, well, is Garland a 6 foot glorified spot up shooter? I think that's where Cleveland's roster, you could make a lot of arguments there that there's some moves to be made, but it's a little.
Can
early,
I throw one out at you? Talk.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this would not work under the cap. Both teams, I'm sure, would hang up the phone. But I'm literally just off the top of my head. If you were Cleveland and you were able to swap out Allen and Garland for OG Anunoby and Mitchell Robinson, and we're going to pretend in this fantasy world that Mitchell Robinson was a healthy basketball player and that they could depend on him, like, would that not maybe make your team better? Like, and again, because here's the other thing about Mitch.
Even though Allen might be better than Mitchell Robinson in a vacuum, Mitchell Robinson is better for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And OG, you need that wing length more than you need Garland's creation. Even if you have Garland ranked ahead of OG, which I wouldn't, some people do, that trade makes more sense for their roster.
And you only have to, when you have Jared Allen, who made an all-star team, who's, I don't know what he's making, he's making a lot of money. Like, you kind of have to play Jared Allen 32 minutes a night. Like, maybe they'd be better served with a center that, like, okay, he's only going to play 20, 24 minutes, but they're going to be tough, really good minutes. And then the rest of the time, you have Mobley at the five in this unguardable alignment. And oh, by the way, if, again, to get to the OG point, if you have a big wing alongside him to make the defense a little bit, like, imagine trying to score on a defense with Evan Mobley and OG Anunoby, or not, if not OG, but like someone, you know, like that. I don't know, man.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's right on. I mean, I want like an Isaiah Stewart, like someone like that next to.
I want a big
that I'm worried, like, that dude's going to rip my limbs off. That to me is the best fitting center next to Evan Mobley. Jared Allen, good player. Don't want to knock him too much, who had a really bad night, but he's had a lot of those bad nights and some big moments. And so that's where, with Cleveland, I picked them to go to the finals in the East. Maybe as an overreaction to my concerns about the Knicks after those Cat comments. It's probably an overreaction. It probably was. But, you know, I think Cleveland does have their flaws, regardless of that choice that were definitely put on a stage on opening night. Jonathan, I know obviously you do everything with Knicks Film School. You also have a new show launching. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm. If you turn on your laptop or check your Twitter, you're probably going to see me doing something these days. So yeah, Knicks Film School, where we all the Knicks coverage. We have our YouTube channel. We have the podcast. I have a newsletter on Substack. Again, Knicks Film School on Substack. You can follow me on Twitter, JC Macri NBA. And yeah, started a new general NBA show. It's called NBA Takedown. We actually just went live before I came on with you to talk about the whole gambling thing. And it's a, it, you know, we like talk about the NBA in a serious way at times, and we also have some fun. So if you're looking for a little extra, all like general NBA coverage in your dossier, definitely check out NBA Takedown.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me. Have a good day, man.
Appreciate you, man. Can't wait till next time.
Thanks again to Jonathan, Spike, and Kirk for joining me today. This gambling thing is crazy, man. I'm sure a lot of news is going to come out today and in the days to come as we learn more. One thing The Athletic reported as we're about to close up the pod today is LeBron James was the player that Damon Jones used insider information about, and that was before a February 2023 Bucks-Lakers game. And Jones allegedly had told other people to bet on the Bucks because he knew that LeBron was going to be sitting out of that game with ankle issues. So, look, I mean, anytime LeBron's name is mentioned, even though in this situation, like, you know, he may have known nothing about it, LeBron and Damon Jones have known each other quite a long time as both an assistant coach and as teammates at one point back in the day. So, whew. It's crazy, 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 crazy what we could be learning in the days to come about all of this. But feels like a huge story coming out, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about that. Thanks again to Spike, Jonathan, and Kurt for joining me. Thank you to Emmy and Dakota for producing today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty, as always, for the music. Thanks to you for giving us a listen and a watch. We'll be back again next Monday and Thursday.